22. Rants to the Rescue. Eat My Dust turned out well for a film called Eat My Dust. It was a quick, zany car chase flick written and directed by Chuck Griffith, who had also done the screenplay for Rogers' The Little Shop of Horrors. I played the renegade son of a sheriff who steals a race car driver's jacked-up 68 Ford Fairlane. My love interest was played by Christopher Norris, a blonde beauty who had been one of the stars of Summer of 42. She was outfitted for the occasion in an exploitation flick ready ensemble of white micro shorts and go-go boots. I wore a blue windbreaker and a Union Army-style capy cap. In what was now a familiar pattern, Clint and Dad participated too. Clint as one of my goober buddies hanging out in the back seat of my stolen wheels, Dad as one of the sheriff's incompetent goober deputies. Chuck cast them of his own volition. I never pushed him. There were also a bunch of great character guys in the movie. Dave Madden, better known as Reuben Kincaid on The Partridge Family. The wiry Warren Kemmerling, so good in Close Encounters of the Third Kind and countless westerns. And Peter Isaacson, a gawky comic actor who played Seaman Pruitt in Don Rickles' Navy sitcom CPO Sharky. Making the movie damn near killed me, not because it was unpleasant to do, but because, miracle of miracles, a prestige acting role came my way right after I reached my agreement with Roger. I was cast as John Wayne's young protege in The Shootist, his final film, directed by Don Siegel. So for a short period, I shot Eat My Dust, The Shootist, and Happy Days at the same time. The production side of Happy Days was as ever gracious. They kindly accommodated me so that I only had to show up to Paramount 2 days a week, rehearsing on Thursdays and filming on Fridays. Corman crammed my Eat My Dust workload into just 11 days of the four-week shoot, which took place near Lake Piru, an hour northwest of L.A. For the rest of my time, I was in Carson City, Nevada, where The Shootist was filming on location. I don't know how I shouldered this workload, except that I was 21 and had the physical stamina not to collapse in exhaustion. Barely. The Shootist was a trip, because it starred not only Wayne, but also Jimmy Stewart and Lauren Bacall. The Duke was dying of cancer, and the old gang was rallying around him for one last adventure. That's what he preferred to be called, Duke. When I first arrived in Carson City, Don Siegel met me downstairs in the hotel where we were all staying and suggested that we go straight up to Wayne's suite to meet the great man. On the way to the elevator, we passed the gift shop, and there was the latest TV Guide magazine with Henry and me on the cover. Siegel laughed and bought a copy. "Duke will love this," he said. I wasn't so sure. When we knocked on the door, we were greeted by an instantly familiar figure, tall, imposing, rugged, and bald. "I hope you don't mind. I didn't bother to put on my wig," said the 69-year-old Wayne. He reached out to shake my hand, which disappeared into his like a 10-year-old's. Siegel held up the issue of TV Guide for Wayne to examine. He looked down at it, looked up at me, looked down at it once more, and then said in a pointedly drawn-out John Wayne drawl, "Ah, big shot, huh?" "Thanks a lot, Don," I thought. But Duke and I got along well from that moment onward. He admired my professionalism. Sometimes I noticed he struggled with his lines. While Ms. Bacall kept to herself, and most of the other people on the set were too much in awe to comfortably engage with Wayne, I asked him if he wanted to run his lines with me. That's what I always did between takes. To my delight, he welcomed the suggestion. I went to school on this opportunity, me rehearsing one-on-one with the most iconic Western star of them all. Working on The Shootist was an eye-opener for me, because as legendary and decorated as Wayne, Bacall, and Stewart were, they worked harder than anyone else on set, putting in the hours and doing as many takes as necessary to nail a scene. I had observed this same trait in Henry Fonda, even on a project as half-hearted as The Smith Family. I would see it again when, in the years to come, I would direct Bette Davis and Don Ameche. It wasn't the studio system or their distinctive looks that had made these actors the giants of Hollywood's golden age. It was, surprise, surprise, their common work ethic and commitment to quality. They simply out-hustled everyone else. Still, The Shootist afforded us a fair amount of hang time. I pumped Duke for John Ford stories, and he happily obliged. "Jack Ford always taught me to keep things moving," he said, "and to only give the audience a maximum of 80% of your emotion, even for the most dramatic scenes. It's more powerful for the audience to complete the feeling themselves." Another Fordism he imparted: "If you give them all you can on a picture and the audience doesn't go for it, then hell, give them their nickel back and get on to the next one." Duke and I also played a lot of chess during our breaks. I'm a decent player, but he had a bullish attack style that you would have expected of him. I never once beat him. I was wrong to have been so haughty about deigning to star in Eat My Dust. I learned a lot from observing Chuck Griffith's fast, nimble, low-budget approach to filmmaking, and I just liked the indie vibe around the Corman machine. The movie performed surprisingly well at the box office on its modest New World Pictures terms. Who'da thunk it? So Roger was now especially inclined to let me make a movie. I was in the game. Not since American Graffiti had I felt so fulfilled by my work. My eczema started to clear up. I bounded into Roger's office for a pitch meeting, excited to enter the directing phase of my life. We were joined by Frances Dole, the beloved head of the script department at New World Pictures. She was a slim Englishwoman who, like Roger, struck me as surprisingly elegant for a gatekeeper of Grindhouse. As Frances took notes, I sketched out a few different ideas I'd developed. One was a suitably gritty and provocative noir picture about a detective who cracks a case in the world of snuff films, movies that depict actual murders. I also pitched a dystopian sci-fi movie in which warring countries, rather than sending in troops to battle, resolve their disputes by having teams of futuristic gladiators fight. Roger patiently listened to these pitches and a couple of others, and then politely told me that I had struck out. "It's wonderful to hear actors pitch," he said. "It's so much more entertaining. Ron, you tell these stories very well, but I'm not interested in any of them. They're just not the type of film I make." I was preparing to skulk out of his office in defeat when Roger threw me a lifeline. He told me that New World Pictures had a process for testing titles to see if they held appeal to film-going audiences. The methodology was hardly scientific. He sent out interns to canvas people waiting in line at movie theaters with mock-up posters for films that did not yet exist. "Ron, when we were testing Eat My Dust as a title, there was another title that came in a close second," Roger said. "It was Grand Theft Auto." Think about that. If you could come up with a car crash comedy called Grand Theft Auto, sort of like Eat My Dust, but different from Eat My Dust, I'd probably make that picture, provided that you also star in it. This was well before video game consoles were commonplace, so Grand Theft Auto was best known as a term used by lawyers and policemen. I had to admit, it did have an appealing ring. I left Roger's office on Sunset grateful for the opportunity, but also drawing a total blank. Grand Theft Auto, the movie. What the hell could it be? I knew that Roger liked to move fast, and therefore, I needed to think fast. I wasn't getting very far by myself, so I sought out the help of my most recent screenwriting collaborator, Dad. Up in Dad's office in the guest house in Toluca Lake, we spitballed. I paced around the room while Dad took notes on a pad. Then it occurred to him to pull out from a drawer an outline he had already written. Dad was on friendly terms with Burt Reynolds, and had been trying to hatch a project with him. Bert was red hot in the mid-70s, but Dad had known him pre-fame. Bert had done a guest spot on Gentle Ben in 1967, and a decade before that, he and Dad had first crossed paths when both were in a stage revival of Mr. Roberts. Dad was keen to do a car chase picture with Bert. Car chase movies were at the apex of their popularity in the 1970s. Eat My Dust was Roger's way of cashing in on a trend popularized by such films as Vanishing Point, Gone in 60 Seconds, and Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. Tough guys, hot babes, and muscle cars, the can't-miss formula of the Nixon Ford years. Bert had already been in a smash-em-up called White Lightning and was the logical choice to star in another. And he did, but not Dad's. Instead, he committed to Smokey and the Bandit, a movie developed by the stuntman Hal Needham. Dad's misfortune suddenly became my good fortune. "I think we could adapt this, make it younger and funnier," Dad said, showing me the outline. It wasn't a youth-oriented plot, but I liked that it involved a car chase that stretched from L.A. all the way to Las Vegas. Dad and I started pooling our thoughts and film references. I came with the idea of taking inspiration from Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate, anti-establishment young people on the run, defying the wishes of the older generation. The lead female character, whom we named Paula Powers, defies her wealthy parents' wishes to stay away from my working-class character, Sam Freeman, by stealing her parents' Rolls Royce so that she and Sam can gun it to Vegas and elope. From Dad came the idea to incorporate some of the broad, over-the-top humor of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, the very same movie I took Cheryl to on our first date. Paula's father and his minions take off in pursuit of the runaway lovers via helicopter. An even crazier chase is set into motion when the young man Paula's parents want her to marry, a rich twit named Collins Hedgeworth, Dad loves coming up with kooky names, announces on a radio program that he is offering a $25,000 reward to whoever catches Paula and Sam. This triggers all manner of idiotic bounty hunters to hit the road in pursuit of the lovers and the cash prize. Given the conventions of the genre, I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that Sam and Paula ultimately elude their captors and get married. Dad and I pounded out a draft of this story and turned in a script to Roger with the title Grand Theft Auto. Francis Dole came back to us with a few notes. We made adjustments accordingly. A day after receiving our revision, Roger called me. "Ron, Roger here," he said, his voice full of cheer. "We like your second draft of the script, and we've budgeted to produce the film for $602,000. Which is a lot of money for New World Pictures. We've already designed the poster. Your first shooting day will be March the 2nd. Congratulations. You're going to direct your first film." All I could muster in my relief and shock was a wobbly thanks. It was the fastest green light I have ever received in my filmmaking career, up to and including the present day. In the moment, I was too euphoric and future-focused to see the parallels. My career as an actor began with a providential nudge from Rance Howard. "By the way, I have a son who's a fine actor," he told the receptionist at MGM. Had Dad not come through 20 years later, basically saying, "By the way, I have an idea for a fine screenplay," I'm not sure I would have been given this first opportunity to direct. The Happy Days gang was ecstatic at hearing my news. Henry, Anson, and Donnie told me they were proud of me. Marion Ross agreed to take a part in the movie, working for scale and playing against type as the pushy, entitled mother of Collins Hedgeworth. Gary Marshall requested a cameo, so I gladly gave him a small role as a gangster. Jim Ritz, one of the show's writers and a friend of mine, signed on to play a bumbling cop, and has since appeared in a dozen more of my movies. they were all well-versed in my ambition to direct because, well, because I never shut up about it. I'm sure my non-stop babbling annoyed the folks on Stage 19 sometimes, but none of them ever cast aspersions on my dream. Their spirit was best summarized by Gary, who more or less bestowed a benediction upon me as I was about to undertake the project. "Go get 'em, Ron," he said, a hand on my shoulder. "Go get 'em." I really appreciated the support because I felt that ABC was continuing to heap indignities upon me. At the start of the fourth season, Henry signed a new contract. He had them over a barrel because his original contract, unlike mine, was for only 3 years. When he signed it, Fonzie was just a supporting character. If Happy Days hadn't made it as a series, Henry would have happily returned to New York and acting in the theater. Now he was the hottest star on television. The network gave him a huge raise to somewhere in the neighborhood of $20,000 a week. Meanwhile, I was still under contract for another 4 years and had been offered only incremental raises. I was making $5,000 a week and still putting in the same amount of work as my friend. Season 4 of Happy Days began in 1976 with a three-part episode entitled Fonzie Loves Pinky, in which the Fonz competes in a demolition derby against two hoods known as the Malachi Brothers and rekindles a romance with an old flame named Pinky Tuscadero. Instead of following our usual routine and starting out the season at Paramount, we reported first to a movie ranch in Malibu Creek State Park to shoot the derby scenes. Henry called me and asked if he could hitch a ride out to Malibu. He wanted to have a talk. As we rolled west in my bug, I could sense that he was uneasy, avoiding eye contact and restlessly bouncing his knee. "Ron, I gotta ask you a question," Henry said. "How do you feel? Because look, I know what's happening. The Fonz is taking off, and the show was designed for you to be the star. And they just gave me a big raise." He told me about the terms he had reached with ABC. "I don't know what's going on with your contract, but I want you to know how much I respect you," he said. "You've handled this all incredibly well." I made plain to Henry that whatever beefs I had were not with him. "You're not doing anything wrong, Henry," I said. "You're not letting this go to your head or change who you are. You're a great team player. What you've created is incredible and great for the show. But I have to admit that the whole situation bothers me in some ways." We talked about the Fonzie's Happy Days fiasco. Henry revealed that the idea had come from the very top. He had been approached about it by Leonard Goldenson, the president and founder of ABC. Henry had pushed back against the title change. Goldenson then suggested that maybe Fonzie should have his own show. Henry pushed back against that, too. "I'm successful because I'm in the middle of this show," he said. I had not been waiting for Henry to come to me and clear the air. We were friends. Whatever anger I had in me was never directed at him. But it was so gracious and thoughtful of him to make this conversation happen. "I don't want anything to change about our friendship," Henry said. "I love you, Ron." "I love you, Henry," I said. "We still do. He is the godfather to all four of my children."
The 1976-77 school year was my last at John Burroughs. I treated it like a victory lap. I had piled up a bunch of summer school credits, so my workload was minimal. In the fall, I wrote for the Smoke Signal and convinced the athletic department to let my friend Gig and me take over the public address duties for the home football games, a task we carried out with relish and a little ham. During the spring semester, I was left with only two real classes, leaving me plenty of time to enjoy my final season on the varsity baseball team. All that and my scholarship to Pepperdine was locked in, so I was really in cruise control. Dad and Ron knew I was willing to work cheap, so they wrote me a funny role in Grand Theft Auto. I turned 18 a couple of months before I graduated from high school. As he had with Ron, Dad honored this birthday as another kind of graduation, to adulthood and financial independence. The money that had been stashed away from me by Mom and Dad and the Jackie Coogan Law wasn't as big as Ron's, but it was still a significant chunk of change. I had already splurged at age 16 and a half on my first car, a copper-colored 1975 AMC Pacer. My friends razzed me about buying a soap bubble on wheels, but hey, I thought that all that glass looked space-age cool. I was an idiot. Without air conditioning in the Southern California sun, the car's interior became hot as blue blazes. The four-cylinder engine was too small for my tastes, lacking the giddy-up teenage drivers require. The only saving grace? The hand-operated emergency brake located to the right of the driver's seat. I learned from the stunt drivers on Eat My Dust how to use it as a tool for screech-and-slide halts, a skill I showed off while making donuts in the student parking lot at Burroughs. I drove my Pacer into the ground in less than a year. I traded it in for a Pontiac Firebird. The dealer spotted me $500 for the old car, or 1/6 of what I had spent on it in the first place. This gives you an idea of my maturity level at that time. Life was a baked joyride. I experienced just one minor hiccup. Pepperdine revoked my scholarship when they realized they had made a mistake. It was supposed to be a needs-based tuition award, and I clearly had the means to pay my own way. I was a little pissed off, as I had done nothing to mislead the school, but the matter was easily resolved. The university still guaranteed me a place in its class of 81, as long as I whipped out my checkbook and paid them a few $100 per class. I also got to hang with Ron at Dodger Stadium. One nice thing that he did with his Happy Days money was get season tickets. I bought in with him, so we spent a lot of quality time at the ballpark, enjoying the Steve Garvey, Davey Lopes, Ron Say lineup. The nights that he was tied up with work or busy with Cheryl, Ron would flip me his ticket and I'd take a beer drinking buddy with me. About this time, I discovered cocaine. My weed connection came up to me one day during my senior year at Burroughs and said, "Hey, you want to try some blow? Count me in." At first, I experienced only the upside of the drug. The reason that people get hooked on coke is the quick joy it brings. The first couple of lines opened up a magical window of creativity for me. I was a writer, and suddenly I had a ton of ideas, every one of them the most brilliant ever. I put pen to paper to capture them all, storylines for scripts, novels, articles. Whereas before, I had had difficulty getting started on any given project, my chemically enhanced brain was unencumbered by inhibition. The catch is that this window of euphoria inevitably slams shut, and when it does, it slams hard, with your head caught between the sash and the sill. You go from unstoppable force to self-doubting loser, and the only way to alleviate this comedown is to do another couple of lines. Let's see. Pot, booze, coke. Not the ideal path for Clint College. It was a very slippery slope, and I was throwing down the Crisco. But the wheels didn't fall off right away. I had a few years of using without serious consequences, probably due to a combination of youthful constitution and an equally youthful naivete. Still, my drug use did not escape the notice of my favorite teachers and coaches. While my grades held up, and I never missed a deadline for the school paper, I smelled like bong water and was a poster boy for Visine. Merle Stone, a social studies teacher and my old JV football coach, flagged me one day as I was leaving class and asked me gently but point blank, "Why do you show up stoned all the time, Clint?" I told Coach I didn't know what he was talking about. Graduation was around the corner and my ticket was punched to Pepperdine, so I feared no repercussions, and Mr. Stone never pressed the matter. A year after I graduated, Ron paid a visit to Burroughs High for an event. To his surprise, Mrs. Trimpe, my wise and beloved journalism teacher, cornered him and asked for a word in private. She expressed her concern about the direction in which my life was headed. Ron has told me that he blames himself for not being more aware of the extent of my drug and alcohol intake, and for not doing more to save me from my own twisted judgment. I appreciate the sentiment, but it's ridiculous. He has nothing to be sorry for. He was giving me jobs when no one else was, for God's sake. I was the one who chose to become a toxic Peter Pan, unwilling to grow up. Maybe things had come too easily for me. Even when the regular acting work stopped, I still had my childhood acting money and my Pepperdine opportunity. While my friends were all grinding senior year and fretting about college admissions and next steps, I was kicking back and blazing up. I was on good behavior for Grand Theft Auto, though. That movie was a blessing to me in more ways than one. I was in hot water with my baseball coach over an article I wrote for the Smoke Signal that critiqued the team's performance. We had been a great team my junior year, a playoff team. But then our best players graduated, and in my senior year, we sucked. Halfway through the season, I said so, in writing. I didn't have a byline on the article because my name was listed on the masthead as the paper's sports editor. Our coach called a team meeting and angrily declared that the article was yellow journalism because it had no credited author, and certain information had clearly been leaked, such as the fact that our defense was averaging an error an inning. This hardly constituted a leak. Anyone who kept a scorecard could have figured out that stat. The coach's tirade was no big deal, but then he glared at me and said that whoever was responsible for the article should quit the team. Well, sorry, coach, must run. I have a film to be in. Ron involved the whole family in Grand Theft Auto, and we all wanted to deliver for him. On top of co-writing the script, Dad was an associate producer and had a role in the film as Ned Slinker, as an overly confident private detective hired by the runaway girl's father. Mom helped round up extras for crowd scenes. Cheryl was a production assistant. Dad and Ron tailored a role for me as one of the young yahoos trying to chase down the young lovers. Ron cast me along with Pete Isaacson from Eat My Dust as a pair of dumbass grease monkeys named Ace and Sparky. We borrow the classic Bugatti open-wheel race car that we're working on and join the crazy pursuit. Pete stood more than a head taller than me, so we were funny on sight. We weren't a bad comedy team either. Did I sometimes catch a buzz during production? You betcha. I brought a small canister of weed with me on location in Victorville, California, but I made sure to keep the nose candy back in Burbank.
It's true that I carry around some residual guilt about how oblivious I was to Clint's addictions. Or maybe I mean that I didn't take the warning signs seriously enough. When Mrs. Trempe spoke to me about Clint, I heard her out and appreciated how much she cared about him. But I also kind of dismissed her worry as a generational overreaction by an older person who didn't get how commonplace pot had become. As I said, my college roommate grew it, and my American Graffiti castmates smoked it. I had no idea at that point that Clint had started to use cocaine. Even if I had, I don't know that I would have taken drastic action to stop him. In the 1970s, cocaine was still considered a party drug. I remember a somewhat frothy New York Times Magazine trend piece whose headline was, "Cocaine, the Champagne of Drugs." There was a prevailing notion that coke was naughty, but not that naughty, or even particularly dangerous. Cocaine was all over show business in the Happy Days era. I never saw anyone take it, at least not knowingly, though I did notice that some people had grown out their pinky fingernails for scooping and snorting. And in various bathrooms at parties, I saw remnants of rails on the counters and spent vials on the floor. People were careful around me, though. I always got treated like Father Ron with the collar, the person you wouldn't dare take a toot in front of. I never once tried cocaine. I had a vivid dream about trying it, though. This was right at the peak of its late 70s popularity. It was like the Al Pacino version of Scarface before that movie existed. I was at a party, surrounded by girls in gold lamé miniskirts and guys with shirts open to their navels, and there were mounds of cocaine being passed around on trays. People kept offering me some, and I kept saying no thanks. But my fellow partygoers were so persistent that I finally said, "Okay, all right. Screw it." I dipped my nose into one of those mounds and took a good snort. I actually, in the dream, felt a euphoric rush. Someone next to me was waiting to hear my reaction, saying, "Well?" And what I said was, "Yeah, I know that feeling. That's the feeling I get every time I roll the camera and say action." I guess you just heard my film nerd TED talk. At any rate, you can imagine how excited I must have been in real life when on March 2nd, 1977, the day after my 23rd birthday, I shouted action for the first scene of Grand Theft Auto.